Nearly every town has a ghost story. As you can imagine, it is extremely rare when a ghost story can be traced back to a specific, legally documented criminal case. But they do exist, and the stories can be even scarier with real-life content. Here are some horrifying murders that created spooky legends involving ghosts. This story takes place in 1897 in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, in the United States. Elva, who went by her middle name, Zona, was a pretty young bride. She was married to a handsome man, Aramis, who was a blacksmith. Shortly after their wedding, on January 23, 1897, she died from heart failure. Or maybe complications from a miscarriage. Or maybe murder. The death report listed childbirth as the cause of death. Zona's mother was heartbroken, but insisted her daughter had been murdered by Zona's husband. Zona's mother, Mary, was against the marriage between her only daughter and Aramis from the start. Although she didn't know it, Aramis had a criminal record and had served 2 years at the state penitentiary for stealing a horse. Zona's mother didn't know that he had been unhappily married twice before. His first wife divorced him after he abandoned her and their child. The second died when Aramis accidentally dropped a brick on her head while he was making repairs on the roof of their home. It is known that when Mary met Aramis, she did not like him. Zona eloped, wearing the same high-collared burgundy dress that she would wear after her death. In the morning of her death, Aramis left his blacksmith shop and went to a nearby house, asking the son to go to his house to ask if Zona wanted him to pick anything up from the store before going home. The boy went to the house and found Zona lying on the floor, dead. Even the young boy could tell she was dead. Later, the Greenbrier Independent, a newspaper, would report that after Dr. Knapp was unable to resuscitate Zona, Aramis requested the doctor to make no further examination of the body. The Dr. Knapp helped dress the body and put a high collar around the neck, and a large veil was folded several times and then tied in a bow under her chin. It was observed by a number of witnesses that the head seemed to be very loose from the neck and would drop from side to side when not supported. Zona was buried in the local cemetery the next day, the day after her death. Even for those days, that seems super quick. In the next few weeks, Zona's mother said her daughter had appeared to her several times and told her what really happened with her death. Mary told her account to the county prosecuting attorney, and he actually didn't dismiss her, but instead asked for names of people who might have information that could help the case. When the prosecutor spoke to Dr. Knapp and learned how the husband had prevented a full examination of the body, the prosecuting attorney had Zona's body exhumed and an autopsy was performed. Zona's body was examined on February 22, 1897. In the local one-room schoolhouse. The autopsy lasted 3 hours and found that Zona's neck had been broken. On the throat were marks of fingers indicating that she had been choked. The neck was dislocated between the first and second vertebrae. The ligaments were torn and ruptured. The windpipe had been crushed. Aramis was arrested and charged with the murder of his wife. The trial began on June 22, 1897. Sona's mother testified and was adamant that it was not a dream. Sona told her that Aramis was mad that she didn't have meat cooked for supper. The second night that Sona came to her, Sona told her that her neck was squeezed. Sona came to her four nights in a row, giving her mother specific details of her murder that her mother couldn't have known. Aramis's lawyer questioned her extensively on cross-examination, and she didn't waver in her account despite the intense badgering. The judge found it difficult to instruct the jury to disregard the story of the ghost, so he allowed it, and he allowed Mary's testimony. And many people in the community seemed to believe her story as well. It took the jury only an hour to return a verdict of murder in the first degree, recommending Aramis be confined to the state penitentiary for the rest of his life. A lynch mob was formed intending to take Aramis from jail and hang him, but the deputy sheriff was able to stop it before any damage was done. Four of the mob's organizers later faced charges. Aramis died in the third year of his sentence on March 13, 1900, from the flu epidemic. No one from his family came to claim his body. He was buried in an unmarked grave in the local cemetery. The state of West Virginia has a state highway marker near the cemetery Sona is buried at. The last sentence reads, "Only known case in which testimony from a ghost helped convict a murderer." In November 1901, in coastal South Carolina, a beautiful 19-year-old woman named Nell disappeared. The last person to see her alive was her longtime sweetheart, Jim. They had been dating for 3 years, and Nell was getting impatient with Jim being hesitant to propose. The rumor was that they argued that night and may have been on the verge of a breakup. Based on the fact that he wasn't convincing at all when questioned by police, Jim was arrested for kidnapping and suspicion of murder. A month later, 2 days after Christmas, her body was found floating in a nearby river. It showed evidence of severe head trauma. Certain townspeople wanted to lynch Jim immediately, but Nell's family insisted he get a fair trial, which he did twice. The first guilty conviction was overturned when the North Carolina Supreme Court declared a mistrial. The second trial convicted Jim on a charge of second-degree murder and sentenced him to 30 years in prison. Jim did not take the stand in his own defense at either trial. Jim was pardoned by the governor in 1920. To the end of his life, he maintained his innocence. Shortly before his death in 1932, Jim spoke with the editor of a newspaper and revealed everything he knew about Nell's murder. Allegedly, the editor left believing Jim was innocent and was going to run the story right away. But before anything could be published, 1 week later, the editor died in a car accident. And the next week, Jim shot himself and died. Local legend says Nell still haunts her former home, perhaps trying to convey the truth about her mysterious death. Strange occurrences like lights going on and off by themselves, doors opening and shutting, strange gusts of cold air move through the house, even sightings of her ghost have been reported by occupants of the Victorian home, which still is a private residence. In January 1804, people in Hammersmith, an area in London, England, were feeling uneasy. For the past 3 months, local residents had been reporting multiple sightings of a ghost around the area. But on one evening, it would take a shocking turn, which would lead to a murder trial. The implications would not be resolved until 180 years later. The Hammersmith ghost had first been spotted in November 1803. This entity wasn't just floating around the West London neighborhood. It apparently was attacking people. Several people claimed to have been physically grabbed or pushed in and around Hammersmith near the cemetery. Some people thought it was the spirit of a man who had killed himself and whose spirit could not rest. Descriptions of his appearance varied, but most stated that it was tall and wore white. Of course, some people were skeptical that this ghost was everything claimed to be. One witness allegedly said that the ghost had been discarding a white tablecloth before running off. Many locals remained frightened by the possibility of a supernatural presence haunting Hammersmith. The whole area had the jitters. Thomas was a local bricklayer, and he liked to wear white clothes. People in the area were starting to notice. A few people had been startled by Thomas at night. His wife even asked him not to wear white, but Thomas insisted on wearing the same white clothing. On January 3rd, 1804, a local man, Francis, decided he was going to look for the Hammersmith ghost, and he took a shotgun with him. So if he thought it was a ghost, it's hard to know how he thought bullets were going to deal with it, but Francis was patrolling the area with his blunderbuss gun, and Thomas was making his way home late at night. Francis had a few ales throughout the night. He spotted Thomas, calling out, "Who are you? What are you?" And then he shot his gun. It quickly became clear that the victim was no ghost, and Thomas was taken to the nearby Black Lion Inn, but it was already too late, and Thomas had died. Francis confessed to shooting Thomas, but said he genuinely believed that he was a ghost. Francis went on trial for willful murder later that year. The jury had to answer the question, "Is saying you thought someone was supernatural a defense against murder?" The jury returned with a verdict of manslaughter rather than murder. The judge wasn't happy, and he forbid the jury to consider the factor that Francis believed Thomas was a ghost. The jury were told to deliberate again and either convict him or clear him of murder. This time they deliberated and came back with a guilty verdict, and Francis was initially sentenced to death. His sentence was later reduced to a year in prison with hard labor. Maybe hard labor feels like a year or feels like a lifetime. I'm not sure. How does it go from sentenced to life to a year? A man named John came forward claiming to have been responsible for at least one of the sightings of the ghost. He said that he had been annoyed that his apprentices told ghost stories to his children, which scared the children. And one night, John decided to dress up in a white sheet to scare the men, and he probably ended up scaring more than his coworkers. Over time, the Hammersmith ghost faded into history, but the question of Francis's intention remained open. In the early 1980s, a man had witnessed what he believed was a person assaulting another, and he started attacking the man. It turned out the alleged assailant was actually apprehending another person on suspicion of theft and was not attacking him. The person who had intervened was convicted of assault, but appealed on the grounds that he genuinely believed the victim was the one committing the crime. After considering the case, the judges agreed with his argument and overturned his conviction. The tale of the Hammersmith ghost and the unfortunate case of Thomas and Francis would go on to be remembered on a plaque outside of the Black Lion pub, where it is still can be seen today.